This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show number 141. Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. You can find us at pitchvision.com. You can call us on
0208 816 7691.
And you can email us on
coach@pitchvision.com.
My name's David Hinchliffe, and this week I'm joined by Mark Garraway. Welcome along to the best cricket podcast on the internet. That's one in the eye for the Switch Hit podcast, isn't it? Over on Crick Info, we won't mention them too much. But face facts, where else are you going to get such a plethora of fantastic information as you are on this show? Hi, Gareth, how's it going?
Yeah, well, thank you, David. You all right?
Yes, so I'm bearing up under all the strain. We've got quite a good show lined up this week with Des Haynes appearing as the guest on our interview section. But unfortunately, we've got no burners. He's missing in action somewhere in America. So hopefully we'll be able to track him down for next week. But we've got plenty of things to talk about.
Yeah, there's a decent substitute there in Desi Haynes, to be honest.
Yeah, well, exactly. You know, if you want a man to learn a thing or two about opening the batting, he did score 26,000 first class runs, so he knows what he's talking about.
Absolutely right.
But I did notice this week that in the UK there's talk of returning to a 50 over format for the domestic competition, which to me is good news. But it made me think, because a lot of people say, you know, well, the defenders of the 40 over format say, well, you know, there's no real difference between 40 and 50 overs. You just look at England's performances in the UK, and it's you know, it's not affected by teams at list A level playing 40 overs. So it made me wonder, is there a big difference between 40 and 50 overs? 10 overs seems like a lot to me.
Well, I think there is, and more importantly, Andy Flower and Alistair Cook think there is, which is where this has all come from, really, the change for England. Obviously, the England's fortunes in 50-over cricket hasn't been particularly brilliant over a long period of time. You know, we got to the finals in 92 and 96 of a World Cup, but since then, the performances have been poor, particularly when it's travelled away from home. So you know, that there's a definite push towards going back to 50 overs cricket, because otherwise all of these young players, and remember that Flower and Cook are looking towards 2015 World Cup, and that's where all of their selections and emphasis is going to be. You want those guys to be coming into the same format as they've been playing at domestic level. And you know, 10 overs is a huge difference. It's 60 balls. And if you think about that in the context of a 2020 game, it's half of a 2020. I think it's a great move if they can get it through in the ECB. I understand the money-making elements of the counties will have noted over the years that the shorter the format, the more people they get into the grounds. You know, that has to be considered. But in a very pure way, I look at, you know, what are the formats that you're playing around the world in at the top of the world game, and it's 50 overs. So ideally that should be replicated throughout the next level of cricket down.
It makes me wonder if there's any way of finding out whether that playing that different format, because although it's essentially the same game, albeit that much shorter. I wonder if that makes much of a difference when someone makes the step up and starts playing a longer format of cricket. I mean, if you look at a lower level, for example, if you've got youngsters who are brought up playing 20 over and then they go and play men's cricket and maybe they're playing 45 over cricket, you know, that's a bigger jump, but it's a big jump nevertheless, and it takes a little while to get used to it. I remember playing my first 50 over game. I don't think I could walk the next day after keeping wicket for 50 overs. We've also seen just a quick mention, because when we're recording this, we've also got the Indian West Indies One Day International going on. We've just seen another batsman cross the 200 mark in a 50 over match, which is a fantastic performance, isn't it? So well done, Virender Sehwag, for racking up 200.
Absolutely. I mean, what a fantastic achievement that is. And you know, scoring at four and over individually or more throughout a 50-over game is pretty startling, really. And no surprise that it's him, because of the way that he bats. But I mean, that's only going to be good for the 50 over game, isn't it? To have it, people going over 200s and scoring big scores, and it goes to show now that just getting 70 or 80 in 50 over games isn't enough. If you're in, you've got to capitalise and get big scores to win games of cricket.
Yeah, 219 and 149 balls. That's not bad, is it? He can sleep easy tonight.
I'd have thought so. I think he'll have to sleep easy tonight. Be interesting to see how much fielding he does over the next couple of weeks.
You think that'll take it out of him for the rest of the summer? Dear?
something to watch.
We also got moving back to more amateur levels. We also got a question recently regarding a law which we would normally cover in the question section, but it doesn't quite. I don't think it's quite enough of a question to cover in the question section, but it was an interesting enough question. I thought we would talk about it a little bit. The law that says if the ball pitches more than twice or rolls along the ground, then it's automatically a no ball, which catches a lot of people out, actually, because a lot of people think it pitching twice is a no ball, but it's more than twice. It's three times or more. And, that reminded me of a while back. There was somebody working on a ball which bounced twice to try and as a 2020 variation. I think it got outlawed pretty quickly by the ECB at the professional level. But I just wondered if you could ever do something like that. You know, tactically, could you ever get away with something like that if you worked on it hard enough?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. It all depends on the interpretation of the lawmakers, really. And as you say, that was a few years ago, and the notion was a slower ball bouncer, which would be so short that it would dip and be almost a yorker on the second bounce, was what was being muted around. And in fact, we had a go at it. Some of the England bowlers had a go at it, but then very, very quickly the powers that be sort of trampled down on that one, and it became, you know, it became a no-goer. But I mean, it's innovation, and I think innovation is a good thing, and I think that would take one heck of a amount of skill and mastery to be able to nail that, because if you get that wrong, obviously it's going to become an incredibly easy ball to hit. But yeah, I mean, we enjoyed having a go at it, but as you say, the lawmakers came in and said that wasn't going to work. But it's innovation. I like innovation, particularly in that short format of a game.
Of course, you can still do it at club level. There's nothing stopping you from doing it. I think probably the ECB have outlawed it in Premier League cricket at the top of club level. But you know, if you're playing a friendly game on a Sunday, and you could get away with it, but yeah, it would take a heck of a lot of practice to get right, wouldn't it? How did the England bowlers do? Don't have to name names, but how did anyone get on? Did anyone get it right at all, or was it all over the shop?
It's difficult, isn't it? You know, we only practiced it for a day or so because they acted so quickly, but. Yeah. Really interesting to see people have a go at it. And the challenge that those guys have is that the pitches are really hard, and also most of them are very tall as well. So in order to get the ball up and down before it gets to the batter is quite a difficult task for them. And somebody like Stuart Broad, who's got a fantastic slower ball bumper, really struggled to get the ball to come down again before it got to the batter. So on slower and softer pitches, I could see it working. If it was allowed, and if people mastered their skill. But it's like anything, you've got to practice it huge amounts to be able to nail that under pressure in a game, that is for sure. And it'll be a braver man than me that has a go at that first time round.
Well, I would love to know anyone who's got any ideas like that, anyone who's tried it, or anyone who's got any ideas listening to the show, similar kind of completely out there ideas maybe they've been doing it. I can imagine some wily old bowler somewhere in village cricket has some thing that they do on a regular basis that they get away with, and it gets the umpires getting out their copy of the laws just to double check to see whether it's legal or not, and it turns out that it is, even though you feel like it shouldn't be. So any of those kind of weird and wonderful variations that are either intentional and you practice them, or just one day the ball slipped out of your hand and you thought, hang on a minute, I've got something. I'd love to hear about those. I don't know about you, Gareth.
Yeah, definitely. Anything like that. It's always a good discussion point, if nothing else.
Exactly. Time now for the interview section. And if you have been looking at the website, pitchvision.com, this week, you know that Desmond Haynes has been doing some preview videos of his online coaching course called Batting Lion, the Desmond Haynes Masterclass. And as part of that, we're doing an interview with Des from that course, so you can hear a little bit on the show. And if you like what you hear, you can head over to pitchvision.com/Des Haynes and get a little bit more information about how to enroll on that course and get all the videos and all the worksheets that you want for picking the brain of a man who was part of one of the best opening partnerships of all time. So Des is coming up after the music.
Okay, so we'll start with the general Fire in Babylon, that's the documentary that came out recently. What did you think about the documentary itself?
Yeah, well, I like it, to be quite honest with you. I really think it was really nice to see how they, you know, how they portrayed the team of the 1980s, but also the culture in which, you know, they brought into the whole documentary, you know, where you see a lot of the Rastafaris, you'll see the guys, the groundsmen, the guy, you know, the people from the low echelons of society, you know, being featured in. I thought that was brilliant, you know. Not only the fact that we were very, very good back then, we were a very, very good side, you know, under the supreme leadership by Clive Lloyd and then Viv afterwards. But I liked it. I like it, to be quite honest with you. I know there were a lot of things that were cut out of it, but I like the way how they package it.
Times have changed since those days. How can the West Indies get back towards that level?
Well, I believe that, I don't know how they'll work it out financially, but I believe that even when you look at the documentary Fire in Babylon, you know, I would like to see some of the players who have made us very, very good, who have given us that type of reputation, promoting West Indies cricket. Could you imagine that team of the 80s going around the world telling people, oh, you've got to... you know, invest in West Indies cricket, and you know, you've got to come to the Caribbean and watch it. We've got a very good young side coming up, and doing all the things that, you know, that in the way that you can promote West Indies cricket. I believe that that team, or the majority of guys who are alive and who are willing to do it, would be a good way of how we can promote West Indies cricket and to get people to appreciate the fact that we are going to be strong again. There's no question about it. We are going to be strong again.
Think that the young cricketers, the cricketers coming through now, the ones in the test team now, can find inspiration from those times?
Oh yeah, I was with them. I was with them during the Pakistani tour of the Pakistani series when we entertained Pakistan and when we entertained India. And they were calling me a movie star and they were saying all sorts of things. But those guys watched it about four or five times on tour. You know, and they were very, very, I mean, the young guy, Kurt Edwards, he was very fascinated when he saw it. And there was a lot of the young players, right, who really were very appreciative of the fact that what we have done and the type of cricket that we played back then. Because you would appreciate a lot of those guys were not born yet while we were dominating the world.
And you had a lot of great moments during that time. Can you pick out a couple of moments where you think that was the pinnacle, that was the high point of it for you?
Well, it's always, you know, when you beat England, you know, beating England 5-0 here in the 80s is always brilliant. I'm also one in innings that I saw Gordon play the Lords when David Gower set us, you know, a massive total in the last innings, and Gordon got 214, Larry Gooms got 90 odd, and they got a run up for about 8 or 9, you know. And that to me was a fantastic innings. And then, you know, I would have seen a lot of innings played by Viv, who I believe was probably the best batsman I've ever seen, or probably one would think, judging from my interpretation, would be the best batsman that the world I've ever seen.
And what about personally, what about your own innings? Which innings stand out for you as an individual?
Yeah, well, when I first started, you know, I was pretty weak against spin bowling, and not that it would get me out, but I would never be able to dominate it. I would always be scratching around and looking to play a little fine sweep or a little slog sweep at it, you know, when possible. And I went to Australia and I got 140 odd at Sydney. I think I got 140 out of 300 and a little bit or something like that. I thought that was like for me to say to the world, look, you know, I can show you that I can play spin now, and I really cherish that knock.
Haynes and Greenwich is one of those cricketing sayings that, you know, it just sort of rolls off the tongue. It's one of the great partnerships. How do you, how does that feel when you're walking out with someone that you've built up such a great level of trust in your work with?
Well, Gordon and I, our relationship was based on a lot of trust. Huh? I think that I was very appreciative of the fact that Gordon was the number one player, and Gordon always used to let me know that he's the number one player. I never get the opportunity to face first ball. I got it once when I was in Barbados in a game that was just a little bit of a charity game, a farewell game for us. I think it was the vice-chancellor game that we played in Barbados a couple of years ago against England, and I got the opportunity to face first ball. And, you know, he was definitely the better player. There's no question about it. He was more complete. You know, when you look at it, Gordon played a lot of cricket in England. He would have had a lot of years of playing county cricket, gaining a lot of experience. While I only started playing county cricket back in 1989, you know, when I played for Middlesex. So it was a situation where I did appreciate the fact that Gordon is number one, and I'm not here to compete with Gordon. You know, I'm there to make sure that the partnership grows and we become very strong, and also we do the job that the team requires. You know, giving the team a start is always very, very important, and we felt that way. You know, it was a situation where we figured, well, look, you know, if we can give the team a start, you know, got people like Viv, at the time, Kashiran, Lawrence Rowe, Clive Lloyd, you know, the likes. And then later on, you had Larry Gooms, Richie Richardson, Viv Richards, and those guys coming in to, you know, it's going to make us really, you know, a very, very strong batting lineup.
Would you say that was part of the strength of the team at the time, was that the egos didn't get in the way and everyone work together for a common goal?
Yeah, we played as a team. I mean, sometimes the egos did get in the way. You know, you can't help it. It's human nature. You know, sometimes, you know, when Gordon felt that he was batting so good that, you know, he felt he was the number one batsman in the world then. There was times when I was batting really well and I thought that I was really good. I was number one. I thought I was number one player in the world as well at some time. So, you know, it depends upon that little purple patch you might get. You might start feeling that, you know, you're definitely playing well and you think that you're really good. But, you know, we always used to play for what the team benefits, you know. And I think that in a situation like that, you can say you might be batting good now, but it's very hard for you to say that you're a better batsman than Viv Richards. I mean, at the time, Viv was unbelievable. And, and we played the cricket in the right spirit as well. You know, we wanted to do well. We were tough. You know, we wanted to do well. But even though our bowling was very, very strong, you know, a lot of people obviously do not really appreciate the fact that, you know, when we were bumping the hell out of people and, you know, giving people a barrage of short balls, it was very difficult for them to give us back, you know, some of our medicine, because we had Haynes and Greenwich, you know, who were capable of handling the short ball, and it didn't seem as though that it would worry us that much. And then if you get Haynes or Greenwich out, you had Viv coming in who was brutal towards the short ball.
Were the best that you played against?
I still think Australia. You can never really discard Australia. I still think Australia was a very, very, very formidable side, especially when you look at the likes of Alan Border's side, you know, that we played against as well. We've got a lot of respect for Alan Border as well, because we thought that he was one of the toughest Australians that we've played against, you know.
And individuals?
I mentioned Alan Border. We had the opportunity to play the likes of Botham, Gower, and Mike Gatting. Then you had, you know, Sunny Gavaskar, who I thought was one of the best opening batsmen in the world I've ever seen. You know, we had the likes of Tanduka, who is still playing right now. There's a lot. I mean, I can go along and call names, you know, for the people who have played in our area for a long time, because we, even though we were a very strong side, we used to appreciate people from the other territories who were playing well. I remember in Barbados, we had this Jimmy Amanaf playing very well against the West Indies team, getting hit by Malcolm Marshall, coming back and hooking in for two sixes, you know. You know, we always used to appreciate that, and we used to really appreciate the toughness in the opposition, sometimes the ones who are really up for the fight.
Time now for the questions section on the show, and as Berners isn't here, I'm going to take over the reading out of the questions, and I've picked out a couple which I think, Mark, that you will be able to answer fully and completely without any input from me. So let's see what we can come up with. And if you have not listened to the show before, then you won't know that the best question of the week always wins a prize, which is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And of course, the Desmond Haynes course is the latest to be available. So perhaps you might want to have a look at that if you send in your question. And you can send in your questions to the normal offices, which we will give you at the end of the show. So let's find what we've got in this week's mailbag. The first question is from Divyanath. And Divyanath says, I'm a left-arm medium-pace bowler from Sri Lanka. I practice in the indoor nets mostly, and I'm a swing bowler, and I usually bowl out swingers to left-handers. I've tried to bowl in swingers by changing the shiny side, but the ball seems away and doesn't move like an in-swinger. I've tried hard to bowl in swingers by changing my action a bit, but no results have been achieved. I've tried to keep the seam pointing towards leg slip to a left-handed batsman. Please suggest a way to train bowling in-swinging delivery. So we've got a left-armer bowling to a left-armer mirror of the other way around. What's your tips on that?
Well, I mean, firstly, the ball that looks like an in-swinger but ends up nipping away seems like a useful ball, so don't lose that one. You know, because deception and natural variation is something that gets people wickets, whether it's intended or not. So if you can learn how you need to pitch that and master it, then that's that becomes a decent ball to add to the armoury. But you're doing the right sort of things, lining up the seam in the way that you talk about to leg slip. You might want to tinker around with the alignment of that a little bit, because sometimes legs slip. So maybe try taking on just outside the leg stump of the batter as an alignment for that, and see what effect that has. But the big thing really to me is the role of the thumb. So if I'm working with bowlers that are looking to swing the ball, and it's important to have the thumb on the right position on the underside of a ball to help that ball along its way. So check your thumb out. The normal ball that you bowl, which is the away swinger, your thumb will be on its edge, and it would be interesting to see whether when you're trying to deliver this in swinger as well, whether you retain that one on its edge. Ideally, you want the flat of the thumb on the ball for that in swinger. And let's see how that then changes the alignment of the wrist. And the wrist will probably find that it's ending up going towards the batter's stumps more so if you put that thumb flat on the underside of the ball. So that would be my first point of call. It says also in the question about changing action. To me, you don't really want to be changing the action at all. And the best swing bowlers in the world, somebody like a Praveen Kumar, who's a swing bowler, a right-arm version, admittedly, there'll be no change in action between his in-swinger and his away-swinger. Going back through time, Wasim Akram would be somebody that you wouldn't be able to pick any change in the action. And it would be purely by the thumb position, the wrist position, and the seam alignment. So just tinker around with those sort of things. Definitely get the flat of the thumb on the ball and then see how you go.
Interesting follow-up question to that from me is that, coaching at club level, you find that you just have to kind of work with the equipment that you've got. So, you know, sometimes you've got balls which are old balls and they're not going to be swinging no matter what you do. So what do you do when you're working with bowlers who are trying to improve some kind of swing in swing or out swing or whatever it is? How do you do you have balls which are, you know, specifically you keep to one side, which are, you know, very shiny on one side, or how do you get over that problem of just some days the ball isn't going to swing?
Yeah, I mean, you keep some balls to one side. The other thing you do is have the split red-white balls. So even if a ball isn't swinging, you know that it's doing the right things in the air, that if there was a shine on the ball, that it would tail in the direction that you want. So that's another thing. But to me, part of the whole thing of swing bowling, and I alluded to this in an article a few weeks ago in the coach education section, is being able to look after that ball. Because you can have the best swing bowlers in the world, but if the ball isn't in a condition that allows you to execute your skills, then you know, you're not going to get anything out of it. So to me, even if you haven't got balls that are shiny in your practice, part of your practice has got to be learning how to get them into a condition that allows your swing bowlers to use it. So, you know, nets isn't just about hitting line and length. It's also about getting that ball into nick. So, and I think it's often a miss, I don't know, it's not really worked on enough in practice. And you look at the Pakistanis down the years, and you talk to people like Mushtaq Ahmed, and test players are being dropped for not looking after a cricket ball because that's how important it is to them. So it's something that I would encourage, even with old balls. People can get enough shine on an old ball to be able to get it to move laterally, and it should be practiced more often at club practices.
Okay, next question is from Gagan Buller, and it's a batting-related question. It's a little light on information, so probably what we're going to have to do here is just give sort of general advice rather than specifically answer Gagan's question. Gagan says, hello, I'm an all-rounder, and I get difficulty in playing the cut shot on the back foot. Please, can you help me? So what would you say the sort of top two or three things that you see a young player doing when they get the cut shot wrong?
Well, the first thing you look for, I think you always look for what's happening just above the ground. So that will be where their position is. So where their body position is in relation to the ball. And a lot of the time, youngsters either choke the shot by getting too close to it, which means that they can't then unleash a chain of upper body and get the appropriate distance with their arms and get the good part of the bat on the ball. Or alternatively, their back foot moves back and outside leg stump, which means that they're then reaching for the ball so much that they lose power and lose control. So the first thing that I'd look to do, really, if you watch some of the best cutters in the world cutting cricket balls nowadays, they get their back foot cutting the off stump or covering the off stump and no further towards it than that. So your stumps can be a really good indicator of where that body position is. So that would be the first thing I'd look for, is the body position. Then after that, if you're in the right position, then the body can do its thing and strike the ball. So that's the first point. The second thing I'd do to get them used to that is get them in that position. So put them in there and start to throw balls. So they just then start to isolate the top half of the body, because one of the major things that goes wrong with a cut shot is that the plane of the bat comes too flat into the ball. And as a result, the ball gets hit in the air because the bat isn't coming down on the ball. In years gone by, we were talked about rolling the wrists on the cut shot, and that's a very difficult timing thing to do. So what you try to do to take that out of the equation is make sure that the backswing comes from high to low, and then as a result, when the ball is made contact with, the bat face is pointing in an appropriate fashion to get the ball to go down. So I'd feed balls in from halfway down, outside off stump, with the batter in that stationary position, just to isolate that strike and get used to hitting high to low. So that would be the first point of call, and then you'd start to introduce movement into it by getting them to stand in their normal stance, throwing exactly the same ball and getting that step and swing motion into the ball, so they're increasing the power by transferring momentum up the body to get into that swing and then strike the ball nicely. So that would be my first two points of call: the base, where the base is, and then isolating the top half and getting used to coming from high to low onto the ball.
Well, we're working blind, of course, so that hopefully one of those two, or perhaps both of them, are enough to just get you motivated to get into the nets, Gagan, and start working on that cut shot with somebody giving you some good feeds that you can start smashing it into the side netting and get the feel for it so you can do it better in matches. That's your lot for this week. The show is drawing to a close, but before we nip off back to the ether, we have to choose a winner for this week's competition. And just to remind you, if you send in a question and it's chosen as the best question, you win a prize, which is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And you can send in your questions to us. But before we tell you how to do that, let's decide on this week's winner. So, Gareth, who's the best question this week? Was it Divinayath or was it Gagan?
Question of the week for me is Divyana's question about being able to bowl an in-swinger to a left-hander as a left-arm medium pace bowler.
Congratulations, Divinayath, and there's a couple of bowling courses that you might be interested in, so we'll get you one of those. Now, if you want to send in your own questions to the show, then Mark, what's the best way that somebody can get those questions to us?
You can email us on coach@pitchvision.com or contact us on 0208 816 7691.
Yes, you can. You can get us on Twitter at PV Cricket Coach, and you can head over to our Facebook page. If you do a search for Pitch Vision Academy, you can find us there. You can also find us in iTunes if you want to subscribe to the show, and why wouldn't you? As I said at the start of the show, it's the best cricket podcast on the internet, and you can do that by doing a search for Pitch Vision Academy in iTunes. If you don't have iTunes, then you can go to pitchvision.com. You can grab the feed and put it anywhere you see fit. That's all for this week. So until next time, we'll see you next week. Cheers, Gareth.
Cheers, David. Take care, mate.